from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. 1985 marks the 400th anniversary of English America. Between 1584 and 1590 came the first attempts at English colonization in the New World under a patent obtained by Sir Walter Raleigh from Queen Elizabeth. These efforts led ultimately to the failure of the Roanoke Island settlements off of what is now the coast of North Carolina. But they contributed later to the success of the Jamestown, Virginia settlement early in the 17th century. What did those first English settlers expect to find in the New World? How did they conceive of its geography, climate, and inhabitants? These questions form the basis for an exhibition now on display at the New York Public Library. The exhibition is entitled Raleigh and Roanoke, and that's the subject of the following discussion on Soundings. The panelists are Karen Kupperman and Helen Wallace. Karen Kupperman is a professor at the University of Connecticut. She recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, and she's the author of an article about the Roanoke voyages that appears in the August-September 1985 issue of American Heritage magazine. Helen Wallace is map librarian at the British Library. She participated in the preparation of the Raleigh and Roanoke exhibition. The discussion for Soundings begins with comments by Helen Wallace about 16th century English expectations regarding America and the New World.
One thing one has to remember is that until about 1520, they didn't really know whether America was a complete continent, whether it was attached to Asia. Indeed, that question still continued right into the 1560s onwards. And it really, this other world across the Atlantic was regarded as a barrier and a disappointment. The countries wanted to get to the Far East with the great wealth of the Indies, the cloves, and so they were anxious to find a way round the barrier.
So what we now call the United States was not even a stepping stone. It was an obstacle. There was no real commercial interest in the New World.
Well, this developed. Once Spain had discovered the great empires of Mexico and Peru and had begun to exploit them, then, of course, the New World certainly changed its guise and became a land worth exploiting in its own right. But for a country like England, which hadn't got yet a foothold in the New World, the barrier concept was still very strong, and England was hoping to get to find a way around the north of the continent and possibly to plant a colony as a halfway house. And you find Sir Humphrey Gilbert, the half-brother of Raleigh, the elder half-brother of Raleigh, producing his discourse for this discovery of a northwest passage to Asia. And America looks very conveniently, for America to be circumnavigated round the north. Actually, the map was based on a great map by Abraham Ortelius of 1564, and then Gilbert in 1566 does a little bit of editing with it, and it's in a very much reduced form. And he shows that the northwest passage is a very easy route from England to Cathay.
Helen Wallace, you are a map librarian at the British Library. What did maps have to do with all of this? There's an obvious connection, but I want you to tell me.
Well, the first thing to say is that one of the problems for Englishmen wanting to plant a colony in America was that they had very poor maps. It was very difficult to know what America was like, both physically in terms of the appearance of the country and in terms of the actual delineations of the continent.
So they had to imagine it in many ways.
In many ways. And that is why they had to depend on foreigners coming in who had experience. And you find, you see, with the Roanoke colonies that Walter Raleigh recruits the services of Simon Fernandes, who had a very somewhat disreputable career as a privateer, but he was indispensable because he claimed to have been to the coast of North America, and he led them to the Carolina Outer Banks. But this is the thing, you see, they had this very great lack of good maps.
Karen Kupperman, tell me, what did the English expect in terms of, I guess just the word for it would be environment, climate, conditions. What did they expect? What did they really find?
Well, they didn't find what they expected. I think they were very fearful of coming especially to the southern parts of North America.
Why
or
would
to
that
the
be?
West Indies. Well, if you look at the map and you see that all of England is north of Newfoundland, or virtually all of England is north of Newfoundland, they thought that they were going to unrelentingly hot climates. Mm-hmm. And they were very much afraid of what this would do to them, because they believed that they could have good health and maintain their Englishness only in climates that were similar to the ones that they lived in. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, they were wrong. We have a cold winter season throughout North America. They didn't understand the dynamics of climate. They didn't understand that the climate on the east coasts of continents is always different from the climates on the west coasts. I think that's also part of why they thought they could go around the top of North America, as Helen Wallace was describing, because in those latitudes in Europe, in Western Europe, it would not have been as cold as it is in those latitudes in North America.
Now, there was also a sort of philosophical, maybe the word is metaphysical, corollary to these notions about climate. That is to say, human behavior, how to stay healthy, where illness came from. Karen Kupperman, tell me about this.
Well, they believed that the four humors in the human body exist in a perfect balance in your native climate.
Now, tell me what those are.
Oh, fire, air, earth, and water.
Right.
It's blood, phlegm, yellow bile, and black bile. And they believe that all illness, they didn't have a germ theory of disease, they believe that all illness is created by an imbalance or a corrupting of the humors. So they thought that when they came, for instance, to a southern location such as North Carolina, they would go through a period of readjustment of this balance, and that some of them would die, all of them would be sickly, and ultimately they would not be as English as they had been. They believed that character is a product of the environment, and so they were afraid of becoming like the Spaniard, like the Portuguese. And of course, the interesting thing about it is that they did, in fact, go through such a period when they first came here. Everybody who came to Virginia virtually went through a two-year so-called seasoning period of extreme debility. Many of them, half of them, did die. Certainly, I think in the very beginnings of some colonies, you do have a kind of disease of the mind. You get in Jamestown in the very early years, people saying that people are dying of some kind of withdrawal. But I think after those early years, it's not psychosomatic. They're getting malaria and other diseases from the environment.
Helen Wallace?
We also find that Raleigh, when he was sending the colonists out, he sent with them, of course, Thomas Harriot, who was a trained scientist, if you could be such in those days. I mean, as near of a trained scientist you could be. And he was to report on the plants and the herbs, and this was partly to discover what herbs would be used, what herbs the Indians themselves would use to cure diseases. And one finds in Harriot's report that he takes great account of this, and of course they not only bring back the reports of plants, but the actual plants themselves, and John White, the artist, brings back the drawings of the plants, and then John Gerard records these in his herbal of 1597. As a matter of fact, of course, that herbal is part of the most interesting independent documentation of the Roanoke colony. So, in fact, they had a highly intelligent attitude to the environment. You probably know that Raleigh himself wrote scientific texts, medical recipes, and so forth. We brought several volumes of this kind over in the exhibition so that people can read that Raleigh's own writings on the subject.
How reliable was this information that these Elizabethan colonists garnered from the Indians? Did they learn a lot? Did they put this to good use?
Yes, I think they learned a lot. It was a very scientific report that was brought back and fully documented in a quite remarkable way. Would you agree on that, Karin?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
So they were willing to learn from the Indians. But let's shift the focus of our conversation. We're talking about Elizabethans, the Romans. Roanoke voyages and attitudes toward the New World and what these the explorers would find. How did they feel about the Indians themselves? It sounds there's a bit of a contradiction here. They were willing to learn from them, and yet it's an ugly word, but racism is one of the accusations thrown around. Do I have that right, Karen?
I think it's difficult to use the word racism. They did not believe that the Indians were of a different race. That one of the early questions, again, of a scientific nature that interested them was who the Indians were. Since they believed that there was one genesis.
Mm-hmm. So they were human. I mean,
Not only were they human, they were considered to be of the same racial stock as the Europeans. One of the favorite theories was that they were the actual Ten Lost Tribes, or remnants of the Ten Lost Tribes. But there was no question in any of the early explorers' or colonists' minds that the Indians were, in fact, of the same race as themselves. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in fact, one of the things that they were interested in was how did they change their color? They thought they dyed themselves with walnut shells, tea, and all sorts of things. There were all sorts of theories, but they did not believe, they believed that they were white.
Mm-hmm. Helen Wallace?
One thing that has come to light in our work on the exhibition, Raleigh and Roanoke, and this is my colleague Peter Barber in the Department of Manuscripts who brought this up.
That's at the British Library.
At the British Library, that's right. That we've got the manuscript from the Sloan Collection of William Strachey, the secretary to the Virginia colony, the Jamestown colony. Mm-hmm. And he uses the illustrations from the Roanoke colony, the debris engravings, to depict the Indians that are actually the Indians of the Virginia, the Northern Virginia. And he makes a very interesting comment in relation to what you might call comparative ethnography. At the back of his of the debris engraving of the dancing circle, he writes, "Wild as they are, accept them, so were we. To make them civil will our honour be. And if good works be the effect of minds, which like good angels be, let our designs, as we are angly, make us angels too. No better work can state or churchman do." So he's making this play of the angles and the angly, going back to the time of Pope Gregory, of course. And he's making very strongly the point that the Britons also were once barbaric. And now it is the mission of the English in Virginia to civilize these peoples who are in the present barbaric state, as he thinks.
Karen Kupperman, Helen Wallace, we're talking about the Roanoke voyages and the settlement of the New World by Elizabethan English men and women. Helen Wallace, tell me, what did the Indians have to do with the maps that these English explorers used? You have pointed out in your conversation that the English were the beneficiaries of Indian knowledge about the land and medicines and food. Were the Indians eager to help in this regard? My larger question is, did the Indians realize what these white men and women were up to? That they were really after this land in the long-range sense, and why, therefore, should they help them?
Well, I think they were very interested in what the Englishmen were doing, people like Harriet and White, because Harriet makes remarks about the instruments, that some of the instruments were regarded as from the gods because they were curious for the Indians. So the very good mapping of the area must have been done with collaboration from the Indians. And I think we can say that the accuracy of John White's map of Virginia has never been fully revealed before. Now you can see it compared with remote satellite imagery, which we obtained from NASA. And we've got a blow-up of the John White map next to the NASA imagery. And you see how remarkably good the White map is in the bearings and everything like that. As to the question of what the final purpose was, I should think the Indians were worried that there was going to be further activity, I mean that it could lead to the losing of land. I don't know whether Karen agrees with that, do you?
What about Karen? That, Karen Kupperman?
Would they be worried?
Well, one of the great puzzles in all of early colonization is the fact that the Indians helped every group, from New England down to the West Indies. And of course, if they hadn't done that, those colonies would never have been established. Colonization would have been retarded. Mm-hmm. So the question is, why did they do it? Of course, the Roanoke colony was never intended to be much more than a base, at least in the beginning. So they may not have, the colonists themselves may not have thought of it as a land-grabbing operation. I just wanted to say something about your other question about whether the Indians saw the English as supernatural. Mm-hmm. Because Harriet has what I think is a very poignant passage in the Brief and True Report about he had learned a bit of the Indians' language before he came, and he tried to talk to the Indians about Christianity and tried to find out about their theology. And so he gives us a much fuller report than we have even from much later colonies. One of the things that happened in all of North America when the English first came to a region was that the Indians fell sick of European diseases to which they had no immunity. Mm. You find whole villages sometimes being wiped out.
And what would some of these have been? Measles, for instance.
Measles, influenza, the plague sometimes, typhus. Yeah. It goes from smallpox. It goes from diseases like smallpox and typhus that we recognize as serious down to the common cold or influenza. If you have no immunity, you know, those can be very serious diseases. And Harriet reported the Indians as saying that their way of understanding what was happening to them was that the English must be risen spirits huh. risen from the dead, that some of them were visible, but others had not yet become visible, and these other invisible English people were shooting invisible guns. It's obviously a connection between the technology that was new and the diseases that were new, and they thought these invisible bullets were somehow striking them. Hmm. One of the problems you see with the disease is that when it would first appear in a region, Indians who may have been exposed to it but had not yet shown any symptoms would run away. And so the disease could show up miles beyond where any English person had ever been. And so it looked like it must be a supernatural phenomenon. And the saddest part of all is that the Indians became convinced that God had for some reason decided to take their land away from them and give it to the English.
This is an odd and an ironic corollary to the notions held among some of the colonists that, Karen, as I have read what you've written about New World exploration, mm-hmm. that the hand of God would be found in the weather, for instance.
Yes, yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, they believed that all natural phenomena exhibited the hand of God. And it's very interesting because an earthquake, for instance, they saw as a judgment of God, mm-hmm. or a severe bout of weather, or a comet. The reason I think it's so interesting is because scientists of the day could explain to you what comets were. They could predict, those that come back with regularity, they could predict comets. They could predict an eclipse of the sun or the moon, but they still believed that it represented a judgment.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a conversation about Raleigh and Roanoke, the subject of an exhibition about early English settlement in the New World, now on display at the New York Public Library. The Soundings panelists are Karen Kupperman and Helen Wallace. Karen Kupperman is a professor at the University of Connecticut. She recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. Karen Kupperman is the author of an article about the Roanoke voyages, which appears in the August-September 1985 issue of American Heritage magazine. Helen Wallace is map librarian at the British Library. She participated in the preparation of Raleigh and Roanoke.
Helen Wallace, Karen Kupperman, we're talking about exploration in the New World, the Elizabethans, Sir Walter Raleigh, Queen Elizabeth. We've talked about money, we've talked about race, we've talked about geography and map making. Tell me about the military. Didn't that play a very important, wasn't that an important element in this New World exploration and, for instance, in the making of maps? Helen Wallace?
Well, the first colony itself was a military outpost, mm-hmm. in essence, and the mapping of the area, therefore, was very important for when Raleigh would want to have the document back at home to study and to see the relationship of the colony to Florida. Mm-hmm. It was so near, and that was a Spanish settlement. And this is one of the reasons why you get the policy of secrecy. Hmm. You get a sort of conflict of interest about maps, that England is obviously wanting the world to know her exploits on the one hand.
But wanting to keep them secret.
She needs very urgently to keep them secret.
Yes.
And I think it is no accident that the maps by White that survive, the map of Virginia doesn't show any latitude or longitude. The map of the Southeast United States area, or North American area, just has a scale of latitude, but that map was never published by De Bree when he published the whole thing in his first volume of America in 1590. And De Bree's map of Virginia doesn't show any latitude or longitude. They were having to keep the colony's position secret.
Hmm.
So it wasn't until the Molyneux Globe came out in 1592 that the Englishmen could see where the colony was.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the danger continued right into the early 17th century, after the colonists might still be alive. So that you find that whereas the maps are of great military significance, at the same time, they're not going to be immediately broadcast to all and sundry.
Karen Kupperman?
Also, I think the fact that all the early colonies, Roanoke and Jamestown, were military colonies leads to a kind of relationship with the Indians. I've been sitting here worrying that we've made it all sound like sweetness and light, which
uh-huh.
it certainly was not.
The connections between the two races, or the two groups?
Yes, relationships between early colonists and the Indians
right.
were not good.
Uh-huh.
In either Jamestown or Roanoke. And I think that is traceable directly to the fact that those were both military colonies to begin with.
Uh-huh.
For these reasons. One is, as I said, because their soldiers live off the land. Soldiers don't grow food. And so that living off the land meant extorting food from the Indians. But I also think there's a deeper reason. I think that Englishmen of this period believed that the world was always potentially treacherous.
Huh.
I think their view of human relationships involves a good deal of treachery, uh-huh. even amongst themselves. And if you allow yourself to be taken advantage of, then it's your fault.
It's not
the other person's fault.
They were very political. They were very sensitive to
that's right.
Who
but
had
they
power
believed.
And,
oh, mm-hmm. sorry.
No, go ahead.
In dealing with the Indians, they believed that massive retaliation for every slight mm-hmm. had to be inflicted, and inflicted immediately. And the kind of thing I'm talking about in Roanoke, for instance, while the first settlement was being built, the commander of the fleet took some ships to do some exploring on the mainland. This is when White did those paintings of those villages that are so beautiful. Well, there's a diary of this trip, which is just terse one-line entries, and one of these lines is positively chilling. They left a village where they said they had been well entertained. A day later, they discovered a cup was missing, a silver cup.
Mm.
And without asking any questions, they simply went back and burned the village to the ground. And then they expect 100 English people to live there over the winter in mm. perfect friendship and amity with the Indians.
Mm-hmm.
It's not possible, but I think their view of human relations was that if they didn't retaliate with everything they had immediately, if they allowed one slight to go by unnoticed, then the Indians would hold them in contempt.
Helen Wallace, Karen Kupperman, let's conclude our conversation about exploration, the Elizabethans, the New World, the Roanoke voyages. How would you characterize our legacy of Roanoke? What would you have a general audience know? All these many elements that you have discussed, talk to me in general terms. Helen Wallace?
Well, I think you could say this. Here was a colony that in 6 years had disappeared. Why was it so important?
Hmm.
I mean, it's been said that but for Cabot and Raleigh, North America might not now be talking English. Well, I think that that is a fascinating subject in itself, as to that it led the way. But I'd like also to make a further point here, that it gave Europeans a graphic, visual image of North America, which they had never had before. It gave them a sort of passport, which they could use in imagining the country and in planning their own voyages there. They brought America into the drawing rooms and libraries and council chambers of Europe in a way that had never been possible before.
Karen Kupperman?
Well, I think the other legacy of Roanoke is that although it failed as a colony, I think the lessons that people learned there made it possible for Jamestown to succeed. They learned, for instance, that you can't have one man with a small circle of people financing and backing a colony. And they also learned that it takes a long time, years, maybe decades, before a colony is on its feet and able to pay its own way. There simply wasn't any gold available in North America. So that Jamestown, for instance, was really a failure for a long time. It sort of limped along with not very much success for about 15 years before they discovered tobacco culture and began to make their own way. But it was because people, I think, were prepared for that, having seen Roanoke's example, that they were prepared to keep pouring money in, knowing that ultimately the colony, or hoping that ultimately the colony would get on its feet. The other thing, there's one other thing, and that is, and I think this is important, I think Roanoke was set up on an aristocratic image. Raleigh was the sort of archetypal Elizabethan aristocrat, and sending out the sort of colony he did, he expected to be tremendously successful and expected the colony to feed into his aristocratic pretensions. I think Jamestown succeeds because it's a merchant's colony. There are aristocrats involved in it, but the merchants run it. And I think that's one of the lessons that they ultimately have to learn. Raleigh had learned it. He had brought merchants in, William Sanderson, as you spoke of. But I think it's Jamestown that really reaps the benefit of this, that you have to have that dollars and cents attitude. You have to know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
They
mm-hmm.
kept their eye on the ball, as it were.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about the Roanoke voyages, which date to the years between 1584 and 1590 in Elizabethan England. The Soundings panelists were Karen Kupperman of the University of Connecticut and Helen Wallace, map librarian at the British Library. Karen Kupperman recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. Her article about the Roanoke voyages appears in the August-September 1985 issue of American Heritage magazine. Helen Wallace participated in the preparation of an exhibit entitled Raleigh and Roanoke, now on display at the New York Public Library. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Raleigh and Roanoke, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, conversations on historical topics with Franklin Ford of Harvard University and Timothy Breen of Northwestern University. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for a discussion about Raleigh and Roanoke, the subject of an exhibition now on display at the New York Public Library. 1985 marks the 400th anniversary of the first English attempts at colonization in the New World. What did those early English settlers expect to find? How did they conceive of geography, climate, and inhabitants in North America? Some answers and insights from scholars from the University of Connecticut and the British Library. Raleigh and Roanoke, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.